Okay, so we're moving. Remember, we started with the idea the universe consists entirely of physical particles in fields of force. What's that got to do with us? You know, here we are, conscious, mindful, rational, intellectual, and all the other things that are so much fun, like suffering the angst of post-industrial man under late capitalism, whatever's your favorite, or feeling the rage of the defeated teams that Barca has defeated, whatever is your favorite feeling. We need to explain that. Okay, now the progression we have gone is from particles to systems, and in particular carbon-based systems, to life, to consciousness, to intentionality, and today we got to language. Okay, so here we go. That's pretty easy, but this, what happened there? We don't know. And then when you get to life and consciousness, we don't know. We know it happened. We know that you get brains like ours, you're going to have consciousness. How? I don't know. Nobody knows. We're trying to work on it now, and I hope some of you will solve the problem. If we have a lot of time, I'll talk about recent research in neurobiology. And then once you have consciousness, intentionality, I think, is fairly obvious. It's a typical form of consciousness, our hunger and thirst and anger and love and hate and disgust. All of those things come to us with a biology. But now we've actually covered a very important philosophical topic this morning. How is language possible? What is language? Something sounds better in German. Was ist Sprache? Okay. Qu'est-ce que c'est que le langage? You like French better? Okay. Now, I have to remind you, I have gone over what is very heavily fought philosophical territory. And I've said, if you treat it biologically, if you think language is just a biological phenomenon, it's an extension of intentionality, which is a more basic biological phenomenon, then it's not very hard. You get conditions of satisfaction for free. How is intentionality possible? Look at a hungry animal or a thirsty animal. That's basic biological intentionality. So if you've got that, if you've got the conditions of satisfaction, then it's no big step to get language. Let me contrast that with some other views. Wittgenstein struggled mightily with this very problem. And in the Tractatus, he asked, what is meaning and what is language? And his answer was, language is a set of devices that picture facts. And how do they do it? There's an isomorphic structure between the structure of the Satz, the sentence, and the structure of the fact, the Tatsache. And the key sentence in the Tractatus is where he says, we shouldn't say that the sentence of the form ARB, let's say the book is on the table, it's on the table, we shouldn't say that says the book stands in a certain relation R to the table. We shouldn't say that A stands in a relation R to B. What we should say is the fact that the letter A stands in a certain relation to the letter B, they both flank the letter R, that says that ARB. It's the fact that pictures the fact, and it pictures the fact because it has an isomorphic structure to the fact. The Satz and the Tatsache. It sounds great in German. Wovon man nicht sprechen kann, darüber muss man schweigen. I wish a lot of philosophers would remember that. That means where you don't know what you're talking about, you should shut up. and I'm unfortunately, that often applies to me. Anyway, what I'm saying is Wittgenstein gave us a very beautiful picture of language. There are these sentences, they picture facts, and the world consists not of objects, but of facts. The problem is, it's a fairy story. That's not how it is in real life. In real life, here's how it is. We are animals running around the woods, and we have perceptual capacities. Now, our perceptual capacities naturally dispose us to pick out certain things as objects. So I treat this as an object, but I don't treat this as an object. If we take the bottom half of this and go around like that, does everybody see this object? It's made by taking a chunk of the bottom of the bottle and the surface of the table. We could have that as an object, but that would be unnatural for us. You might imagine a tribe where such objects are very important. That object is called a clerg. And what I showed you was not a real clerg, but only an imitation clerg, because real clergs are of deep religious significance. They can only be constructed by sacred virgins working under water, okay? So if you do this, you destroy a clerg, there's a death penalty, okay? But fortunately, it wasn't a real clerg, you know, it was just a kind of example of a clerg. Now, that's not our language. In our language, we tend to pick out things by spatiotemporal dimensions. Not always. I mean, nation states, you know, the United States, is that an object? Well, it's got bits and pieces in the middle of the Pacific and something hanging off the coast of Canada. So it's not really a well-defined object, but we Americans have no problem in picking out, or a deck of cards, or a kitchen set. But we tend to pick out objects. And given that we picked out objects, we then use our intentionality to fix conditions of satisfaction. And then I'm arguing it's not a major philosophical enterprise to describe meaning. And you need a crucial distinction between speaker meaning and sentence meaning. Speaker meaning is the intentional imposition of conditions of satisfaction on conditions of satisfaction. And sentence meaning is a form of conventional derived intentionality. In general, we have now introduced something which is crucial, and that is derived intentionality. And that's going to enable us to explain the structure of human civilization. Okay, so the Wittgenstein picture of the Tractatus doesn't work. Now, when that didn't work, it seemed to me Wittgenstein gave up too easily. He says, what I'm trying to do today is impossible. Why? Because I'm trying to say there are only a certain number of things you can do with language. You can perform speech acts that have this structure where you have a certain illocutionary force and a propositional content. So I can order you to leave the room, predict that you will leave the room, ask whether you will leave the room, express the hope that you will leave the room. In each case, you have that you will leave the room as a propositional content, and you have that presented with different forces. Now, in his investigations, Wittgenstein says, what I'm trying to do is impossible. I'm trying to give limits to language. I'm trying to say what we can do with language. And he there says, and I think it's paragraph 23, how many kinds of language games are there? How many kinds of Satz are there? There are countless kinds. Unzählige is his word. And now Austin, my old teacher, used to sneer at philosophers, would say, there are an infinite number of uses of language, and then they'd give a list of 17 or 23. Infinite? 17? 23? And Austin thought we ought to get busy and do a day's work. Entomologists can count a million different kinds of beetles. Why are philosophers so lazy? We can't count a million different kinds of uses of language. Well, I'm too lazy for a million, but I can get up to five, okay? And I'm now going to ask, on the account that I gave you, of meaning as derived intentionality, there are only a certain number of things you can do with language, and it really has to follow from my analysis of meaning that there are a certain number of things you can do. There are only a certain number of types of speech acts. Now, we know that there are an infinite number of propositions, and we know that from the generative of language, from the fact that there are recursive rules that I don't even remember the proposition I gave you about eating all that ketchup on Mount Everest, but you can invent lots of examples of your own. You can have an infinite number. But these, how many of these are there, of types of speech acts? There are a very limited number. The limits are set by the limits of meaning, and I'm now going to answer Wittgenstein's question. How many types of language game are there? How many types of speech acts? There are five, and I'm going to tell you why, what the five are, and why there have to be that five. Okay, now remember, every one of these, every statement, assertion, question, command, order, promises, vow, threat, has a propositional content and an illocutionary force. And as I told you yesterday, whenever you perform one of these, you express one of these. You make a statement, you express a belief. You give an order, you express a desire. You make a promise, you express an intention. These are mental states. This is an act. How many types of speech act are there? I'm going to say there are five, and I'm going to tell you what the five are. And they're defined by the point or purpose of the speech act in virtue of its being a speech act of that type. So the first kind I call assertives. And assertives have as the defining illocutionary point that they are a representation of how things are in the world, truly or falsely. It is a mark of the assertive that it can be true or false. Another way to give the equivalent definition is to say that every assertive is a commitment to truth. Sometimes it's a very strong commitment. I swear on the body of my dead ancestors that I didn't eat the cookies. Okay, that's a very strong assertive. I don't think I ate the cookies. That's a very weak assertive. Same propositional content. The structure is this. We use Frege's assertion sign to mark the fact that it has the assertive illocutionary point. You all know what the direction of fit is. It's word to world. The expressed psychological state, the sincerity condition, that's this thing here. The sincerity condition is belief. And as far as the assertive is concerned, you can assert any proposition. Now, of course, there are subclasses of assertives. If you make a prediction, it has to be about the future. It can't be about the past. But the assertive illocutionary point doesn't restrict the type of propositional content. Any propositional content can be assertives. And the names in English for the standard assertives, or the philosopher's favorite, are statements, assertions, descriptions, classifications, clarifications, explanations. All of those are cases of assertives. Illocutionary point commits you to truth. Direction of fit is word to world. Psychological state, this is the sincerity condition, is belief. And any proposition can be asserted. Okay? Everybody's up with this. If you understand that, the rest is going to be easy. The second I call directives. The defining illocutionary point of the directive is that it counts as an attempt by the speaker to get the hearer to do something. The philosopher's favorites of directives are requests and orders. And we will, following the great Spanish tradition, I don't know if it works in Catalan, we'll use the shriek mark to mark the fact that it's a directive. And the direction of fit is always world to words. The directive is supposed to get the world to change. I say leave the room, then it'll be satisfied if you change your behavior to match the content of the propositional content of the speech act. The Sincerity condition is always desire. When you perform a directive, you express a desire that the hearer should do something. And the prepositional content is always H does act A, and that has to be a future voluntary act A. So the prepositional content of the directive, I order you to leave the room. I suggest that you stop making so much noise. I request that you be quiet. Those are cases where the prepositional content is the future does some future, the hearer does some future voluntary act A. So I can't order you to have eaten more vegetables last week, and I can't order you to weigh 200 pounds because that's not a voluntary action. I can say, imitate General de Gaulle, but I can't say resemble General de Gaulle, because resembling's not a voluntary action you can perform. So the directive is always a future voluntary action, and the names of directives in English are, as you would expect, the favorites are order, command, and request. But you get also a suggest and insist, and a state, a require, and various others. Now, I once gave a lecture at a Catholic university, and they asked me, what is a prayer? And I made a stupid answer. I said, it's a directive. Give us this day our daily bread. But they had a riot. They thought, you're not a Catholic if you think you're ordering God. And they're right about that. You couldn't say, give us this day our daily bread or else. You can't do that. So I have to tell you what a prayer is in a minute. It's not, the standard prayer is not a directive. I thought it was a directive because when I was a little kid and I used to pray for snow, I was a skier, I wanted God to give us snow. I needed snow. But that's a very crude form of a prayer. Okay, we'll get to that. An interesting class of directives are questions. And questions are a fascinating class of directives because the question is always a request for an answer. And it's the speech act of the question is a request for an answer where the form of the answer is determined by the form of the question. Did you eat your beans? Answer, yes or no. And yes means I ate my beans. The WH questions, who, what, where, when, how, leave a blank. If I say how many people were at the party, then the request is to answer the question, X number of people were at the party, and you're supposed to fill in the value of X. So questions are always directives. They're directives to perform a speech act. The form of the speech act is determined by the form of the question. And there are two kinds of questions, yes, no questions, where it's yes or no. Do you have any bananas? And then there are the WH questions, how many bananas do you have? And there the form of the question determines the form of the answer. Now, oddly enough, in English, tiresomely, there are some interesting exceptions. The modal auxiliary verbs are exceptions. I told you, if you think about modal auxiliaries, it'll drive you crazy. Because the question, should I marry a Republican? That's a bigger deal in the United States than it is in Catalonia. Should I marry a Republican is not answered by saying, yes, you should, or no, you shouldn't. It's typically answered with an imperative. Yes, do marry a Republican. No, don't marry a Republican. What's going on? Well, I'll come back, or maybe I won't come back to that. But the general rule is questions are directive. Form of the question determines the form of the answer, with the exception of the modal auxiliaries. And a question is always a request to perform a speech act. Okay. Now, what about rhetorical questions? You see, at the Republican National Convention, a speaker will say,
do we want four more years of this vicious and incompetent democratic government? And the audience is not supposed to think, well, I don't know, do we or don't we? You know, we ought to think it over. It's not a real question. You see, they're supposed to shout in unison, no, you see. I mean, a guy who thinks it over, he shouldn't be there. Okay, so what about rhetorical questions? So we'll get to them, rhetorical questions. Should we think of them as honest to John questions or not? I'll come back to that. Okay. Now, the next class is, again, a philosopher's favorite, commissives. And this is a term I just borrowed from Austin. And the favorite commissive, the philosopher's favorite, is promising. It's always the promise, which is the favorite commissive speech act. And I'll just use a C here for the illocutionary point of the commissive. The direction of fit is always uphill. The world has to change to match the words. The expressed sincerity condition is always intention. I promise to come and see you is an expression of the intention to come and see you, because I can't say I promise to come and see you, but I don't intend to come and see you. And the propositional content is that the speaker, S, does some future voluntary act A. So I promise pay my tax next week. I promise to wash the car on the weekend. Each of those is a future voluntary act. And as I said, the philosopher's favorite is promising, but there are others. Vows, threats, pledges, contracts, guarantees, and warranties are all examples of commissive speech acts. Now, you might look at this and think, well, why do you need two here? Because they both have the same direction of fit, and they both predicate some future voluntary action. It can be a negative action, I promise not to get drunk tonight, and it can be a sequence of actions, I promise to exercise a half an hour a day, but basically it still has to be some voluntary action. Why not assimilate these in one category? And I think there's a big difference, and the difference is this. I can't place you under an obligation in a way I can place myself under an obligation. You see, I can promise and thus obligate myself, but with you I can request, but I can't place you under an obligation unless we're part of some institutional structure. If I'm the professor and you're the student, or I'm the father and you're the child, or I'm the captain and you're the soldier. But just ordinary people cannot place each other under obligations, whereas a promise does place you under. You place yourself under an obligation. You create a desire-independent reason for action when you make a promise. So I think you have to have two different categories, because commissives create obligations in a way that directives by themselves don't. If I walk up to a guy on the street and I say, take your clothes off, he's under no obligation at all. I mean, I just issued a stupid order, but there's no obligation at all. Whereas if I promise to take my clothes off, it may be a stupid thing to promise, but I can create a promise. Okay, everybody up with us so far? And again, as I said, the verbs here are promise, vow, threat, pledge, contract, guarantee, and warranty. What's the difference between guarantee and warranty? I can't figure it out. It looks to me like they're the same. English has very few exact synonyms, and I suppose probably the same is true in Spanish, but apparently it has some. See, English has this advantage in that it has both the Germanic roots that come from Old English, and it has the Latin roots that came from the French invasion. So often we'll have two words for the same thing. We have manual, which comes from Latin, and we have handbook, and that's straight German, Handbuch, as you can hear the German in that. So, okay, I mean, in English you do get these, two words for the same thing, one with a German root and one with a Latin root. And I wrote a book about the logic of speech acts with a French philosopher, and I thought English would have many more performative verbs than French Not so. The French have an enormous number of performative verbs, and I think it's because of their litigious practices. They love to sue each other. They have all these legal arguments, more than Americans. They're worse than Americans are about suing each other. So you get a very rich argumentative vocabulary in French. In fact, one French philosopher has even advanced the theory of argumentation. And the thesis of argumentation is every utterance is really a step in an argument. Okay, that tells us something about the French. I don't think it's true of every utterance. Okay, we're doing all right so far, because here we got orders, questions, requests, and commands. Here we got promise, vows, threats, and pledges. Now here's a messy class that I call expressives. And the illocutionary point of the expressive is just to express sincerity condition. And the favorite examples of expressives are apologies, thanks, congratulations, welcomes, and condolences. And in those cases, I'll just use E here. Now, typically, in those examples, you don't have a direction of fit. It's just presupposed. So I'll put PRP for presupposed fit. And then the state can be variable. You can express anything. You can express sorrow as when you condole somebody. You can express sadness as when you apologize. You can express gratitude when you thank somebody. And then it looks like there's not much restriction on the propositional content, but it seems these have something to do with the speaker or the hearer, plus some property of the speaker and the hearer. So I can congratulate you not only on things you did, those would be actions you performed, but I can congratulate you on what your son did or what your grandfather did. And it needn't be a voluntary action. I can congratulate you on the fact that you got a big nose. That's a hell of a fine nose, I say. Congratulations. But it has to be something to you. Could I congratulate you on the elliptical orbit of the planets? It's wonderful. Congratulations. The planets have an elliptical orbit. Now, if you're Johannes Kepler, I probably can. He discovered the elliptical orbit. But for us ordinary non-discoverers, I don't think you can be congratulated, or I can't apologize for the elliptical. I'm so sorry. They have an elliptical orbit. I don't think that works. So it has to be some property. But the important thing here is the purpose of the Speech Act is to express. Now, sometimes you can have an expressive which has a direction of fit because the expressed sincerity condition has a direction of fit. In the Protestant religion, there's a prayer that goes, I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. It's the Nicene Creed. And there, that isn't expressive. It isn't. You're reporting an item of your autobiography. You're expressing your common faith. And when the congregation recites this, it's clearly an expressive. And that was my mistake when I told the students at Notre Dame, that's how we pronounce it in America, I'm embarrassed, but in any case, at Notre Dame du Lac, I told them that a prayer was a directive. No, it's an expressive, because the purpose of the reciting the prayer, I believe in God the Father, I won't do the whole Nicene Creed, but in any case, it's clear that the aim there is to express it. Now then, we get to a very peculiar category, and that is the category that I call declarations. And the peculiarity of the declaration, let's use D here, is that the declaration changes reality by declaring it to be changed. How the hell does that work? See, the guy stands up there in front of the meeting and he says, the meeting is adjourned. Well, if he's the boss and he's the authority, he can adjourn the meeting just by declaring that the meeting is adjourned. What's going on? All of Austin's performatives, I hear. about that? Does it work? Yeah. One, two, three. No?
We'll see if there's any correlation between the microphone and the truth. Okay. All right. Now, declarations, I think, are an amazing kind of speech act. All of Austin's performatives are cases where you make a declaration. Sometimes the declaration is that you perform a speech act. I promise to come and see you makes it the case by declaration that I make a promise. So on my account, you perform two speech acts. When you say, I promise to come and see you, you make a promise, that's the main point, but you do that by declaring the utterance to be a promise. And here is the strange thing about declarations. They have both directions of fit. And that's not because you're performing two speech acts, you're only performing one speech act, but you're making something the case by representing it as being the case. And that is a stunning achievement. Now, is there a sincerity condition? Well, when I originally wrote this, I didn't think there was a sincerity condition because you couldn't declare war insincerely. Well, that's probably intuitively right, but it does seem to me you do express a desire to create a new reality and a belief that you are creating a new reality. So I now want to say you have both desire and belief in the sincerity condition. It would seem odd to say, I hereby declare war, but I don't think that this is going to create war. Or, I hereby declare war, but I don't want there to be a state of war. Those sound odd in a way that it sounds odd to say, I promise to come and see you, but I don't intend to come and see you. And there's no limit just set by the illocutionary point of what you can declare, but of course there's a very limited number of things that you can create simply by declaration. Now, a good example here is to look at supernatural declarations and declarations such as religious or declarations in fairy stories. When God says, let there be light, what kind of a speech act is that? Well, it's not a directive. It doesn't mean, Sam over there, turn on the lights. And it's not a commissive. It doesn't mean, I promise I'll make light for you when I get around to it. When he says, let there be light, he makes it the case by declaration that there is light. And look at it in different languages. In French, qu'il soit la lumière. I don't know what it is in Catalan, but I bet it's something like that. And in German, Würde Licht. You see that? I mean, I love any kind of subjunctive. I don't understand the subjunctive. I don't know why it's dying, but let's keep it going as long as we can. So Würde Licht and qu'il soit la lumière seem to me good examples, and those are declarations. You make it the case by declaration that there is light, by declaring there to be light. God can do that. We can't. But we have our own declarations. We can declare war. We can adjourn the meeting. We can pronounce somebody husband and wife. We can give and bequeath our property. So there are lots of declarations that we can perform, even though we lack divine powers. We can do a lot. And later on, tomorrow, I'm going to show you how that's the device by which we create human civilization. We create money and property and universities and government and cocktail parties and summer vacations, all by representing them as existing. And you'd be surprised how powerful it is. In the United States, there's an extreme form of academic power known as on sabbatical. People ask you to do something, you can get out of it by saying, I'm on sabbatical. You have enormous power. And that's all by declaration, so I'm going to argue. And sometimes it's not even explicit that it's a declaration. It masquerades as something else. So I carry around in my wallet amazing pieces of paper. And on the, I'm sorry I keep throwing stuff on the floor. I'm not trying to show off here. On this sheet of paper, there's an amazing claim made. This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. Now, all of us here are epistemologists. And we naturally wonder, how do they know? Have they done a study? It says it's legal. How do they know it's legal tender? Maybe this one is and that one isn't. Is there really evidence that it's legal tender? And the answer is, of course, it's not a hypothesis. They make it the case by declaration that it's legal tender. It becomes legal tender because the United States Treasury declares it to be legal tender, declares it to be money. Okay, so that's very interesting. And I used to think, well, this is kind of a marginal case of speech acts where you have these side of effects of double direction of fit. But I now think that's the device by which we create human civilization. I'm going to tell you how that works tomorrow. Right now, I want to talk some more about this categorization. Now, notice, first of all, a single utterance can be many different kinds of speech acts. So the wife says to the husband at the party, it's really quite late. That's an assertive, but it's a directive. It means, let's get the hell out of here now. And it can even be a commissive. It can even be a threat. If you don't stop drinking and come home with me, you're going to pay a hell of a price. And it can also be an expressive, I'm fed up with you. So a single utterance can be a very large number of these all at once. Furthermore, in ordinary speech, many of these are typically performed indirectly in that you perform one speech act by way of performing another. Directives are the favorite for indirect speech acts because typically it's impolite, at least in English, just to issue utterances in the imperative mood. You don't say, pass the salt. You say, can you reach the salt? Could you reach the salt? Could you pass the salt? Is that the salt ever there next to you? They never put enough salt on the pizza in this place. You can say all kinds of things, and those are what I call indirect speech acts, where you perform one speech act by way of performing another. Now, in very serious situations, you don't use indirect speech acts. You have to make it fully explicit. I have a textbook for the French Army from 1834 in which they list the commands. And it's very boring. It says, pour faire commencer le feu, le capitaine dit commencer le feu. Okay. And pour faire cesser le feu, le capitaine dit cesser le feu. You see, and I used to think, how stupid. You see, how boring. But in fact, it's not so stupid. You know, men are dying, there are shells, and you don't want a hyper-sophisticated captain who says, don't you chaps know when enough is enough? You see, oh, don't exaggerate anymore. You don't want that. You want a guy who says, cessez le feu, or some other equally explicit command. So they give you explicit things. In certain circumstances, it has to be made fully explicit. The President of the United States in swearing in can't say, well, yeah, I do kind of go along with the idea of supporting and defending the Constitution. That's not good enough. You have to say, I solemnly swear to protect and defend. Well, you know the stuff. So sometimes you can do it indirectly, but sometimes you can. And why do you do it indirectly? Well, in the case of directives, it's more polite if you do it indirectly. If you don't say, pass the salt. You say, can you pass the salt, or I'd like you to pass the salt, or would you pass the salt? Why is that more polite? It pretends to give the hearer a choice. Would you like to pass the salt? Well, let me think it over. No, that you don't do that. But in fact, it doesn't give him a choice. I mean, the woman in front of you at the opera turns around and says, do you mind if I leave my hat on? She's asking your permission. Permission is a commissive. Now, there has to be a polite way to say, no, I would mind if you left your hat on. So the best way is to counter with an indirect speech act and say, would you mind taking it off? And that way, I think Trump in the same suit works well in that sort of case. So I think, as I said, you do get lots of indirect speech acts where you perform one by performing another. And typically, directives are the source of indirect speech acts. And cultures differ with how much it's impolite to issue the imperative. It always seems to me in Germany, I hear more imperatives, beilen Sie sich bitte, that kind of stuff, where you don't hear so much of that in the United States. Airline hostesses are the worst of all. They say things like, if I could see your passport, yeah, then what? You know, it's an antecedent of a conditional. Then what? But of course, they don't mean that. They mean it as it's a request. It means, give me your damn passport, but they won't say it so rudely. They put it in this absurd form. Now, there are all sorts of other permutations on this. So just as you can have the speech act of the asserting the conditional, if P, then Q, you can also have conditional assertions. So you have if P, then assert Q. This is of the form, if it rains, the ground will be wet. But here you get things, well, if you really want to know, Sally's pregnant. Okay, that doesn't mean Sally's pregnant. Pregnancy depends on your epistemic state. That's not it. It isn't that there's a conditional dependence of pregnancy on epistemology. It rather means, if you really want to know, I'll tell you that Sally's pregnant. So you get both conditional assertions and assertions of the conditional. Similarly with directives, you can get conditional directives and directives of the conditional. If I say, for example, if you go out, take your raincoat, well, that is a conditional order on the condition that you're going out, you're ordered to take your raincoat. And you can obey that order just by not going out. But if I say, if you go past the Jones's house, return their copy of the Critique of Pure Reason, well, there you can't obey that just by deliberately avoiding going past the Jones's house, because there, you're given that order on the condition that you're going past the Jones's house. So you get cases like this where you get if P, then FQ, and those are conditional speech acts rather than speech acts with a conditional propositional content. Okay, so you get lots of variations within this. You get indirect forms, and you get utterances that have several different illocutionary points at once. But now I said, well, this is the limit on what you can do. Why aren't there other kinds? Well, let's think of some possible examples. One other possible. How are we doing for time? Have I got a few more minutes? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Here, what about fiction? You see, should we think of novels as a special kind of speech act? So instead of just assertives, directives, committees, investment declarations, we have I hereby fict. That once upon a time there was a girl that wore a little red riding hood. That seems to me exactly wrong. No, fiction is not a separate class along with all these. Fiction is typically a class of assertives where you suspend the direction of fit, where you break the commitment to truth. So when you begin the story, once upon a time, there was a girl named Little Red Riding Hood, and she lived in a house, a gingerbread house with her grandmother. That is a case where you're going through the motions of making an assertion or acting as if you're making an assertion, but it's not a genuine assertion. It won't do to ask, well, how do you know her riding hood was red? You see, maybe it was blue, because you're not actually committed to truth. So fiction is not a separate kind of speech act on all fours with these. I have seen literary theorists who tried to claim that, but it doesn't work. Fiction is rather an ordinary suspension of the commitments of speech acts. Typically, they are assertives, but you can have other sorts of utterances in a work of fiction. So we shouldn't think of fiction as a separate category of speech acts. Rather, it is a suspension of the normal commitments, the normal rules of speech acts. Now, I sometimes said, well, we should think of fiction as parasitic on non-fictional discourse, because you hear the fictional utterance as if it were a non-fictional utterance. Well, God, literary theorists had a fit when I said that. Parasitic. They thought, oh my God, it's some filthy parasite lurking in the body of real language. No, that's not it at all. There's nothing demeaning to Shakespeare to say, well, it didn't really happen like that with Macbeth. It's just a work of literature. And there he suspends the normal commitments. It's not a legitimate criticism of Shakespeare to say history was in fact different from the way that he describes it, because it's not, he's not committed to representing how history actually occurred. He's trying to produce a work of literature. On my account, fiction names a type of speech act where the normal rules are suspended. Literature, whether or not it's fiction is up to the author. The author gets to decide whether or not it's fictional. But literature is not up to the author. Literature is a matter of a collective acceptance or agreement to count certain things as having a certain type of status, having a certain cultural status as literature. So the writing on the bathroom walls is not part of Catalan literature. It may be fictional utterances, but it's not a piece of Catalan poetry, whereas I have a book of Catalan poems, and that's part of Catalan literature. Okay, well, maybe we can have questions about that. Okay, so let me just summarize. There are a limited number of things you can do with language, and basically, they're set by the properties of the mind. You can tell people how things are. Those are assertives. You can try to get them to do things, or you can commit yourself to doing things. You can express your feelings and attitude, and you can change the world through your utterances. These are limits set by the possibilities of imposing conditions of satisfaction on conditions of satisfaction. See, why can't I make it rain by saying, let it rain? You see, it doesn't work for me. If I'm God, I can do that, but the rest of us can't do that because it goes beyond the possibilities set by meaning. Meaning limits what you can do. There are only so many ways you can relate utterances to reality, and they're set by your biology. So you have, these are the limits of what we can do. This is the remarkable one. And I don't know any other animal that can do this, and it's going to turn out that's crucial for the creation of human civilization, and we'll do that one tomorrow. We'll talk a lot about that tomorrow. Let's take questions now, then.
We have to pass the microphone.
Yeah.
So, any? One, two, let's count how many are there? One, two, three, four. Okay, let's.
Yes. Do all declarations necessarily require authority? Do all declarations necessarily require authority? A previous rule that establishes this person's declaration has force.
Well, a declaration requires that you be in a position to perform the declaration. So that's the and most of those are extra linguistic. So in order
to pronounce somebody husband and wife, adjourn the meeting, you have to have a position of authority that goes beyond. But some declarations you can just perform by being a competent speaker. And those are the linguistic declarations. You can make a promise just by saying, I promise. And that declares the utterance to be a promise. You can say, I request that you leave the room just by being a speaker of the language. So not all declarations require an extra linguistic authority, just the declarations that go beyond language. You can't declare war, adjourn the meeting, find somebody guilty as charged, unless you have an authority that goes beyond just being a speaker of the language.
Another one having to do with declarations first. You attach declarations to this desire in a way as the condition of sincerity or the kind of sincerity involved. And you used the example of the declaration of war. And I cannot quite see why do you need to desire to declare war in order to declare war. And mainly in all of the fulfillments of duty, I think that you might fulfill them by declarations without having the correlative desire.
Declarations can often be performed implicitly. So, for example, somebody can become the leader without anybody saying, you are the leader. They just assume a leadership position and they're treated with a kind of respect, and it's assumed that the decisions can't be made without the approval of such and such a person. And all of that functions implicitly as a declaration. So you can have indirect, just as you can have indirect orders and indirect statements, so you can have indirect declarations. It seems puzzling that that's so, but I think it is so. And often that's how leaders emerge, how the leadership comes out in a group, not because anybody's officially declared to be the leader, but because a series of other speech acts, so to speak, add up to the declaration that this person has that status. I'm going to say more about that tomorrow when I talk about status functions, how there's an elaborate series of power structures in society, and those are created by speech acts that have the form of a declaration, but it's not always an explicit declaration. I took it that was the point of the question. I'm not sure that I got it, though.
I can think of declaring and performing the speech act of declaring without that involving a certain desire. When I, as a commander-in-chief, declare war to another country, I might not desire to declare war, but that's what I ought to do. So this is the thing. And I do have another one. I don't know if I should say it now. All right.
It's one thing to say, could I declare a war without there actually wanting to be a war? But the question is my declaration of an expression of a desire that declaration should create a state of war? And there I think it is. If I declare a state of war, then I have to want that utterance to be a declaration of war. Now, I might think it's a bad idea to have war, and I wish we didn't have it, but I do want that utterance to constitute a declaration of war.
Yeah, it has to do with the relation or the difference that you talked about between commissives and directives. I take it that the central feature you used to distinguish them was the idea that with commissives you can always like sort of impose obligations on yourself, but that is not something you can always do with directives. And you mentioned that in the case of directives, you have this sort of exception of institutional directives where this does apply. I mean, that you do create obligations on others. But I guess you will say some more about the institutional, the features of the institutional, but I can think of the idea that if I don't know, strong enough and there's no one around us, I can tell you to do something and you will in a way be obliged to do that something. So I wouldn't know how to distinguish between these two in such a context. And on the other hand, it seems to follow from what you say that there's a central feature in the idea of obligation, of being able to impose a sanction or menace with a sanction. And I would like to know if this is so for you. Thank you.
I'll say more tomorrow about how obligations create desire-independent reasons for action. But about this specific question, the distinction between the directive and the commissive, if you are a strong person and a bully and you can threaten other people and you tell them to do something, they will do it not because they're under an obligation, but because of fear. that is the reason for obeying the threat is prudential. It's because it's the consequence of not obeying are bad. But the whole point of human civilization is we create these obligations that give us reasons for action that are desire independent, that are not based on just fear. And this is very important for political philosophy. You see, Hobbes tried to make it seem as if, well, all of it is just prudential. The reason for having political obligation is otherwise life would be nasty, brutish, and short. But other people, I am one, think, no, we create systems of institutional structures that commit people in various ways. And the commission is like making a promise. You undertake an obligation. So I want to say, doing something because you're under threat and you're going to suffer if you don't do it is quite different from doing it because you're under an obligation, because you've undertaken an obligation to do it. So I am giving a lecture here on such and such a day. I promised to do it. And it's no good my saying, well, I don't feel like lecturing on that day. Here I am. No, I lecture whether or not I feel like doing it because I under an obligation. It's not that I fear there's going to be some punishment if I don't. Probably there isn't. But it's all the same. I do have desire independent reasons. And this is a strong claim I'm going to go out in detail tomorrow, and that is, this is the key to understanding human civilization and how it differs from animals. When I train my dogs, I try to train them to have desires they wouldn't otherwise have. And you do it with bribery. You try to give them more rewards. But when I train my children, I try to train them to be able to undertake and keep obligations regardless of whether or not it satisfies some desire.
In the case of, I think this was about maybe a year ago when President Obama started bombing Pakistan, we assume that it was desire independent. But how would you classify that? Would it fall in, what people were saying in essence was President Obama is bombing Pakistan and he's done everything but declare war on Pakistan. How do you fit that into this sort of...
A very good question, but it's a historical question because there are all sorts of factual points involved here. The United States violated Pakistan's sovereignty in all kinds of ways. Specifically, the Pakistanis were busy protecting an evil guy who had done a lot of harm to the United States, so we sent in our guys to kill him. And they succeeded. My son is a lieutenant colonel in the special forces, and it was his group. I mean, he wasn't one of the guys, but they were very happy that they did this. Did they violate Pakistan's sovereignty? Yes, no question. So what? Well, I mean, there are all kinds of desperate situations in which you feel, rightly or wrongly, that you're justified in violating another person's sovereignty, and that was a case where we did something. Now, a much more complicated question are these drones, and I don't have an intelligent opinion about them. I don't know enough about it, but I do know about the attempt to kill Osama bin Laden, the guy who was responsible for the September 11th attacks in the United States, and that was a deliberate attempt to do something that was knowingly violating Pakistan's sovereignty. And they didn't tell the Pakistanis because they knew in advance that if they told them, they'd tip him off. He would be able to escape.
So I have a question about sincerity conditions that goes slightly beyond what you said today and into your work. So basically, the question is the following. We have seen that different kinds of speech acts express different psychological states, and the sincerity condition are as follows. The speaker has to have the psychological state expressed by that particular speech act. So in your work, you said that this is a regulative rule for performing the speech acts. Now, in recent times, there has been a wave of literature in philosophy, in particular on assertives, that takes the sincerity condition to be instead the constitutive rule and the only constitutive rule for asserting. So this is slowly becoming orthodoxy, at least in European university, and it seems to clash with what you said in your work. So I would like to know if you have something to say about this.
I don't know the literature you're talking about, so I can't address myself to that directly. The constitutive or the constitutive rule says making assertion counts as an expression of a belief. That's constitutive. But constitutive rules like that will have regulative consequences. You are violating the rules on assertions if you say something you don't believe. That's called a lie. And there's a regulative rule against lying, but that follows from the constitutive rule that making an assertion counts as, that's my typical form for a constitutive rule, X counts as Y. It counts as a commitment to the belief. It counts as an expression of the belief. So there isn't a contrast between the explicit, between the constitutive and the regulative in this case, because the constitutive implies a regulative principle. And that's typical. I mean, it constitutes a violation of a rule in soccer if you do certain things to the opponent, but that means the constitutive rule implies a regulation against doing this. See, all rules regulate. Constitutive rules have the additional feature that they constitute the very behavior that they regulate. So playing chess isn't just regulated by a bunch of rules, but playing chess is constituted by acting at least in accordance with a number of these rules. And maybe, I don't know this literature, maybe you could tell me about it afterwards.
John, what happens to the declarations if the person making the declaration is not in the position of making the declaration? Is it just like a false assertive, a kind of defective declaration, or does it degenerate, so to speak, into assertive without being a declaration at all?
Okay, that's a wonderful question, and the answer is it depends on the case. There's a wonderful example where a group of men in Philadelphia, they were king's subjects, they weren't citizens of anything, and they were in a British crown colony, these states in the New World, and they declared themselves to be a separate nation. This is called a Declaration of Independence. How the hell did they get away with it? Who said you guys could declare yourself to be independent? Well, okay, the answer is it works if you can get other people to accept it. So the Declaration of Independence of the United States was a declaration. They could have read my book and followed my instructions. They didn't have to. But it was a declaration, and it worked because people accepted it. Now, sometimes the Speech Act isn't enough. In this case, they had to defeat the British Army in order to get the declaration accepted. And it's something Americans tend to forget. They couldn't have done it without help from the French. No help from the French, there'd be no United States. Americans don't want to hear that nowadays, but it's true. So the declaration works if you can get people to accept it. Now, 40 years later, a bunch of people in Richmond, Virginia, tried to do the same thing. Instead of declaring the United States of America, they declared the Confederate States of America. Didn't work. They tried hard. It was a long and bloody war, but after 4 heavy years of fighting, the Confederate States was abolished. It was abandoned. So roughly speaking, the declaration works if you can get people to go along with it. If you can't get people to go along with it, it doesn't work. Now, typically in real life, it works because there's an institutional structure. You see, in an American baseball game, the umpire shouts, out, and you're out. And it's no good me in the stand saying, safe, because if the umpire is the guy that gets to make the declaration, this is what I call an assertive declaration, because he's making a claim that the guy was out, but it has the status of a declaration because it changes reality, that a guy now counts us out. And the fact that I disagree with the empire, well, too bad. He has the authority. And amazingly enough, Americans believe in the authority. They will go along with the empire even though they think he's wrong. And a very unfortunate thing happened in the United States, and that is the umpire in the Constitution is the Supreme Court. Now, there's nothing in the Constitution that says the Supreme Court can decide what's constitutional or not. They just arrogated themselves by declaration the power to do that. It was Justice Marshall just decided to act as if they had this authority, and it worked. So nowadays, Americans regard the Supreme Court as the ultimate umpire. The Supreme Court may make absolutely idiotic decisions, but people will accept it. They accept it because it's a Supreme Court decision. In the 1980 elections, it was clear the election ended in a tie because the margin of victory was much smaller than the margin of error. There's much more error than the tiny number of votes that Bush had that counted as a victory. So what do you do? Well, you can't have a tie. Somebody has to be declared the winner. So for reasons that were pretty stupid, the Supreme Court declared George W. Bush to be the winner of the 1980 presidential election. Americans went along with it. They, okay, he's the winner. In Berkeley, California, they didn't go along with it. And there were many bumper stickers that said, "He's not my president." Well, I don't think they worried too much in Washington because there aren't enough people in Berkeley to make a difference to them, so they don't really care about that. But again, this is a case where the declaration declaring the winner was done more or less arbitrarily, but people go along with it. People accept the authority of the Supreme Court to make these decisions, even though that's not stated in the Constitution. It's just a fact that that's how it works.
Is there some other hands up?
Two more. In.
Okay, well, Mark has another one.
Yeah, Mark hasn't had a chance yet.
Three brief questions.
I was wondering about the case in which we have the state of affairs to which declarations refer. For example, when you say, "I declare that the meeting is adjourned," you're referring to 30 people. Or you're declaring, I don't know, Catalonia to be an independent state, and you're referring to 8 million people. What do you think about how are the conditions of satisfaction of the declaration satisfied? In the case of like having half of the people not recognizing that that your declaration holds, what do you think about?
It depends on the case. If you make the declaration and you get enough people to accept it, it works. But how many is enough? See, when the Confederate States declared themselves to be an independent nation, not all of the Southern states went along. In fact, Virginia was broken in two, and the state of West Virginia grew out of the fact that there was a part of the country that did not want to be part of the Confederacy. So it's by no means obvious, even that the people who are intended within the scope of the Declaration will cooperate. People, in the end, have to make up their minds what they're going to accept, what sort of collective acceptance. And later on, tomorrow, I'm going to tell you about collective intentionality, because it is the key to understanding human society is we have this remarkable capacity to cooperate. But animals can also cooperate. My doggy, back to my boring example, is a pack animal, and he cooperates with other dogs, but they do not create a state. They have no presidents and no policemen and so on. Now, what do you have to add to collective intentionality? So tomorrow we're going to do collective intentionality and how then, given this other stuff that I've been describing to you, you create civilization. Do we have one more question? There's a guy here.
So it's a quick one. You mentioned indirect speech acts as performing a speech act by performing another. I wanted to know, what about the case in which the two speech acts are of the same kind? So for instance, I think about Gricean implicatures. If I imply something by saying something else, it seems I'm performing two assertives, but at the same time, what I'm implying, I'm committed somehow in a different way to what I'm implying. So how does that work?
Often you can perform an indirect speech act by performing another speech act of the same type. So what was the date of the Norman invasion? That's a question. I might not answer that directly. I might say, according to the authorities, it was in 1066. Now that's an indirect speech act because I didn't actually say that the date of the Norman invasion was 1066, but I made another statement, which is an indirect answer to the question. I just say, the authorities say that. Now that doesn't actually commit me to the truth, but the point of my utterance was to make that statement indirectly by way of another statement where you state the evidence. And often you do this. You make an assertive by stating the evidence for the truth of the assertive. Now there are lots of examples of that kind of stuff. The evidence is now overwhelming that smoking causes cancer. Now, I haven't actually said smoking causes cancer, but I have indirectly said it by saying that the evidence is overwhelming. And this is typical. People often do this.
I'm wondering, Bartleby's I'd rather not. What kind of a speech act is it?
Typically, you are declining an offer or a request when you say, I'd rather not. Have another glass of gin, I'd rather not. And that means you're declining. It's a case of refusing or declining an offer. Offers are an interesting class because the offer is a hypothetical commissive. The offer is a promise that made hypothetically, and it becomes effective on acceptance of the offer. And this is legally how it is. If I make you an offer to buy your house, that's a hypothetical promise, but if you accept the offer, then it becomes a promise. Then it's a contract. I'm now bound. So offers are a good example of a hypothetical speech act. You don't promise to do something, but if you make an offer, then it becomes a promise if the offer is accepted.